There's no script to follow of what to say or do or even feel after the person you love dies. No perfect new memory, support group, or activity will completely fill that void that person has left in your space. Yet with time, intentional effort, and all kinds of days, you begin to find the tools that work best for your family to heal. Thank you for joining our Wonders and Worries podcast today. Today we are joined by an incredible parent that I was privileged to meet through Wonders and Worries when her family elected to enroll in our research curriculum highlighting support for families through late-stage cancers. This is Dawn.
I am Dawn, and my husband is Tom, and we've got two beautiful girls, Abigail and Alyssa. They're 12, our twins. And it took us 6 years to have them, lots of infertility issues. We moved to the Austin area from Illinois, from Chicago, in 2014 for my husband's job. And I'm a nurse, so I could pretty much pick up anywhere. So we were excited for the move, fresh start, nobody out here with us. It's just us four. And we were excited about the opportunity.
So as we learn and grow together, we dig right into talking about life after loss. This is Dawn's story.
Went on with our normal lives for the last 6 years and almost 7 years. And one day we were eating dinner, we were having steak, and my husband Tom started choking on a piece of steak. And he got up from the table and it just wasn't going down. So I thought that was kind of weird. And he said, you know, it just, you know, didn't go down the wrong, or tried to go down the wrong pipe. So we didn't think anything of it. And then he took another bite and same thing happened, but this time was more severe. He tried to take some milk down with it and the milk came out. And I knew at that point there's something wrong. Long story short, we ended up going to the doctor, saw the nurse practitioner. She gave us all the different scenarios that it could be, but because of his age, he was only 45 at the time, that he could have allergies that causes different things to happen in the esophagus. He could have acid reflux, and they would just need to go in and stretch his esophagus out where it's tight, where the food isn't passing. You know, worst case scenario, there's a tumor there and things aren't passing because of tumor, but I highly doubt it because of your age. We got set up for a scope, and you know, my husband being the jokester he is, he's waking up from anesthesia and he is telling me that he has a tumor, and he's, you know, saying it's a tumor, like that movie. And I'm thinking this is not funny. I'm not, you know, in the mood for joking right now. And he's, you know, half drugged still. And so he thinks he wants to laugh and joke about it. So the doctor comes up to us and says, well, I've got some bad news. You know, we went down there with the scope and we found a pretty good sized mass that's blocking the opening to your stomach and your esophagus. And we just kind of, I thought, there's no way. He's in the wrong room. This is not why he's here. He was just supposed to get stretched and we were supposed to go home and that was going to be it. And the doctor said that it is this typical kind of mass and that it will need treatment, will need chemo, radiation, possibly surgery to remove that part of the esophagus and reconstruct. And from there on, it was boom, boom, boom. We saw the oncologist right away. Within a couple days, port got put in, chemo started. Because of his age, he was on a pretty aggressive treatment of three different kinds of chemo drugs, and he was tolerating it wonderfully. And they were so pleased, and the results, he was having repeat, you know, scans. We did find out was stage 4 because it metastasized to his rib and spine and different areas of the bones. It never got to the organs or anything, so we're hopeful, and the doctors were hopeful that they could get it with just, you know, chemo alone. And then maybe move to radiation if needed. So we went through the whole course and he did great, you know, diagnosis from his radiation doctor after he had had the intense chemo that they couldn't find it anymore. It was gone. And I'm like, what do you mean gone? And they said, well, we don't see any active cells on the new PET scan. So we were celebrating. We thought, woohoo, this is it. You know, he's knocking this out of the park, you know, working hard, like he always says. There's a point where they could not do the chemo anymore because of the toxicity of the chemo. So we were to move, he was going to move to pill form. And it seemed like after that had happened, that's when the progression, it became really fast, spread more to his bones. He had 2 hospitalizations for mostly for pain. He was in so much pain. And the last one was in April, and he was in so much pain. And I didn't realize that actually the blood clot in his leg actually went to his lung and caused a pulmonary embolism. He was in the hospital because of COVID. We weren't able to see him by the only by FaceTime. That was it. And so I had gotten a phone call from his oncologist saying that she had a conversation with Tom, and they had talked about possibly sending him home, but he would come home on hospice. They wanted to know what my thoughts were on that. Would I be able to do it? And he said he wanted to make sure that it was all up to me. He wanted to make sure I'm okay with it. He didn't want to burden me anyway. And I said, you're not a burden. Come home. I just want you to come home and I'll take care of you. I'll do whatever I need to do to take care of you. And he did say something that broke my heart was, you know, if I come home, I'm going to probably die at home. And I said, I don't care. I want you to come home. I want you to be with your family. I want you to be with us. So that was a decision that was made. And he was here for about 2 weeks on oxygen, tube feeds, the whole gamut. And COVID was still pretty strong, so he was very paranoid about letting too many people in. So it was a very hard time in our life when I needed the support from family and friends, but it was really hard to get them to come in because he was so scared that we were going to compromise himself, me or our girls or the nurses that were taking care of him. It was a really tough time. So he was diagnosed in February of 2019 and he died May 2nd of 2020.
I think it speaks volumes to just even at the very end, how he was still trying to take care of everybody.
Yes. That's
his personality in a nutshell.
Always. It's always the family first before himself. Always. No matter what.
I think that the difference with chronic aggressive cancer is that you are immediately staring in the face of an uphill climb. And so there are lots of preparations and discussions that had to happen. Yes. But what we hear about from some of our parents is that they struggle with having those immediate shifts in conversations because you don't want to take away that feeling of hope as well. How did you find that balance with Tom being able to talk about hard things, but also maintain that resiliency and that hope?
Well, that took a long time because, yes, I was kind of guarded and put those walls up because I didn't want to believe that he was going to be gone. The statistics that I've seen, and in fact, I got a letter from his GI doctor saying, and it bothered me, I actually threw the letter away so that he couldn't see it, that statistics show that anyone with esophageal cancer typically dies within 5 years. And I didn't want him to lose hope. I didn't want him to see that. I didn't want to Google anything and know what could happen because I felt like he was fighting for us and he was so strong. So yeah, to bring up any type of end of life decisions was really, really difficult. As many times as I wanted to bring it up, I would kind of just put it aside. I didn't feel like we were there yet. But as things started progressing and I see how things were getting harder, we actually did have a conversation about getting our will together. You know, we didn't want us being out here in Austin by ourselves, all of our family back in Illinois, we did not want something tragic to happen to the kids where they would be taken care of by the state. We knew who we wanted them to go to. We knew the right people to take care of our finances, you know, if anything were to happen to me. So we just wanted that all in place and get that off of our minds. Wonders and Worries actually set us up with that, you know, some connections there. And it was a wonderful program where we were able to sit down with some lawyers and they did our wills and got all that paperwork out of the way. So we were taken care of there. And that was the summer before he passed. Mm-hmm. Then as things really started progressing, I knew we needed to start having these conversations about a funeral and burial. And that was the hardest thing. But as we're sitting in the parking lot to see if he had a blood clot, I thought, you know, this could be really bad. This could be quick. And the way it's going pretty quick. So we need to have this conversation. And he said, yeah, let's talk about it because I want to be back at home. I want to be around our family. I want to be back in Illinois. So I didn't know if that meant we needed to move back or he just wanted to be there when he died. Mm-hmm. We had a serious conversation about, you know, at this point with his cut, with all his treatments and care, I don't think it's feasible for us to pick up and move back to Illinois. And he agreed. He said, you know, how are you going to get me back to Illinois when I die? I just, you know, I'm hoping to be buried next to my grandparents. And I said, you don't have anything to worry about. We'll get you there. And that will not be a problem. So, and it wasn't, it was seamless. So
it was something that I think the whole idea of planning a funeral during a pandemic, there is no book on how to do that. And
no.
It is such an overwhelming process. I remember part of our role at Wonders and Worries is to prepare your girls for what we were going to see. And so for me, that involved reaching out to the funeral director and asking them, what is this going to look like? Can you explain to me what a drive-through funeral is? Together, we kind of were able to script what it would look like so the girls could feel prepared. But yes. It's just the amount of newness that everybody was having to juggle on top of this tremendous loss.
Right.
I feel like there were just so many moving parts that you were working with.
Right. And I just knew that going back home, we hadn't been home in a couple of years. And, you know, that's where our life, that's where we grew up. That was where we started. And I just knew that going back home and the restrictions that they were having of 10 people at a funeral just wasn't going to happen. It couldn't happen. I mean, there's so many restrictions and the COVID, you know, the scare and people, you know, scared to be around in groups and stuff like that. And we just had to come up with another way. So that was just an idea I come up with. And I'm like, you know, there's drive-through everything here in Texas. Why can't we have a drive-through funeral? I mean, what's, you know, that we've got to make this work. And the funeral director, she was just wonderful. And she's like, you know, sending me pictures. I'm going to work on this. And she made it work. And he was at the entrance of the funeral home. People drove by. We had pictures out there. We had, you know, our whole family was standing with masks on. They were in their car. They stayed in their cars. They drove through and we were able to say hi. And, you know, everybody gave their condolences. And I there was a line of cars for miles. And then we had a police escort all the way to the cemetery, and it was perfect. I couldn't have asked for anything better for him, that I felt like he deserved it so much for all the care that he gave to everybody else and how hard he worked through this whole thing. He needed a celebration.
And it was a funeral parade is what he was getting.
It sure was. It sure was. And that's exactly what he deserved.
Now, a lot of parents struggle with that decision to have their kids participate in the end of life or not. I know that you and I talked a bunch about it, and you were very in tune, both you and Tom were very in tune to what the girls' needs were. There are just so many unique factors with traveling and transporting Tom all the way to Chicago. And mm-hmm. How do you feel like the girls were able to participate in a way that you felt was safe and comfortable for them?
Well, they were in a lot of the decision makings as far as, you know, the clothes he was going to wear for the, you know, in the casket. And they were really involved. And I feel like they were so prepared because of the work that you guys have done to help them. They were strong. They helped me be strong. I felt like they were mature enough to be involved in every step of the decision. And if they didn't feel like it, I have one that's a little bit doesn't like to have, you know, that put on her, or she's not very comfortable with death as much as the other one would step aside and say, I just don't want to talk about this, or, you know, I can't see him like this right now. And it was okay, you know, as he was going through the process of, you know, she just couldn't be there. And my other one could stand there with us, but she would have her moments too. So I would give them, you know, the opportunity if they wanted to be there, if they didn't, you know, to give them a break. So, and I think you guys have prepared them for that.
Tom did a lot of things also to prepare for end of life, like making videos, which you later found out about afterwards. Do you want to share a little bit about kind of the ways that he said goodbye to them?
Yeah, there was a day that I needed to look up something in his phone. I was looking up pictures or something like that. And wanted him, because him and I, whenever we would go to the cancer center, we would take a selfie together every time. And he brought the girls a couple times when I was working and he would take selfies of them. So I had told him, I said, there was one that I don't have. Can I, you know, use your phone and transfer it to my phone? He said, yeah. So I get into that and I see this one video or a video that looks like that's got his face on it. And I said, what's this? And he said, never mind, leave it alone. That's not for you. Like, okay. So I always respected his privacy. I always thought, you know, there's some, he was always such a caring and giving man that there was something that he was doing that wasn't dishonest. It was true. And he was always surprising us. So I knew there was something to it. I just didn't want to pry because he didn't want to talk about it. So after he had passed, going through his phone, you know, to kind of turn everything off, I remembered there was a video. And I had told my sister, you know, there's got to be something with these videos. And I looked and there was probably 100 or so videos. And it was a diary from the very first day he got the news that he had cancer all the way through the end to his second to the last hospital visit. That was his last one. And it was all about his treatments and how good he feels and, you know, that he's done with chemo or that we're going to Disney or we've got family coming into town. And it was a diary on how he was feeling. And he was always so positive. There was a few of them that the hardest one, I think, was our daughter's birthday on January 6th. That one, he was wishing them happy birthday. We had family in town and he was crying. And I think he knew that he might not be here for the next one. So, but to have that and just be able to hear his voice and see his face was the best gift he could ever give us.
Legacy support like that goes a long way. And it's just so amazing that he knew within himself to do that. And what a treasured gift that is, that the girls can always now go back and just hear his voice and watch those videos and be a part of him, even though he physically isn't here right beside them.
Yes.
Back and forth about a decision to go to Disney World.
Yes.
And I know that you had worried, like, what if you went and he was feeling terrible? What ultimately was your takeaway from that?
Well, Tom and I actually had a conversation about it. There was this option to go with my sister and her family at Disney. And he was just finishing up his treatment. So, and that's when he had moved to the pill form. And so we thought, you know, he's in a good place right now. He's feeling pretty good. He's getting stronger. We've had this conversation. What do you feel about this? Do you feel like you can be strong enough? Do you feel, you know, okay enough to go and do this week-long trip, which is going to be a lot of walking, rides, and, you know, just the side effects of the chemo in general aren't fun. And we're going to be in the hot sun and things like that. And he said, let's do it. And I'm so glad we went for it, because that was our last family vacation. And he was a trooper. Of course, he never complains about anything. And the only time he ever went back to the hotel, he wasn't feeling good. He was tired after pretty much a 12-hour day of being out at Disney. He went back before we did. But he was with us from day and night, you know, traveling, and it's something that we'll never forget.
Do you have any advice for anyone who maybe is in kind of like a similar situation where here you were told that they can't detect cancer cells, and then he goes from a pretty quick shift from we're possibly cancer-free to now we're moving on to hospice. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about like how you balance that shock, because it was a complete 180 from the direction you thought you were heading?
It was, because I almost didn't want to believe it, because we knew that it was stage four. We knew that it was metastatic. And when they give us that kind of, you know, diagnosis at that point, saying they just don't see any active cells, my struggles right now, and which I'm hoping to work on this a little bit, more scans, more follow-up for cancer patients, because you just feel like you're in this limbo. You're just kind of waiting for the next step. It's always the unknown, I feel like, is the worst part of the disease. And, you know, from the very beginning, you're wondering, you know, what stage am I? And then it's, you know, how is this going to respond? It's always, you're always waiting. I feel like insurance has played a big part in our care and within Tom's care alone. And that's one of the things that made him very angry about the whole process is the insurance. They just didn't want to pay for, you know, follow-up scans or things that could have really extended his life. And I felt like the doctor's hands were tied a lot of times. They weren't able to do the care. They weren't able to do radiation quick enough. I feel like that's going to be my role. You know, as soon as I can figure out how to do all this and get some of the reports and things like that, I feel like that's going to be my job now, is to try to help other people get the insurance coverage or the care that they need to extend their life so that they can be here longer for their family. Because I feel like we would have had a little bit longer with him.
I think that's incredible advocacy and a great way to honor his legacy.
Over the processes, yes, you have all that support at the very beginning. Everyone tells you that they'll be here for you if you need anything. And at the very beginning, honestly, you have no clue what you need. You have no idea. You're in such a fog. I don't even know how I got through that first month. I was, you know, just going through the process of all the financial stuff, the life insurance, you know, the paying the bills and paying and selling his car and, you know, all that goes along with losing somebody. And then, you know, you have all these people that are, you know, there for you and sending cards and money and, you know, that kind of thing. And then, you know, as the months go on, everyone kind of goes on with their life and yours still is stopped. You know, you're still hurting. I never realized that losing a husband was going to be so much harder, because I'm living it. I see his toothbrush. I see his, you know, his shampoo. He's all around us. We're in mm-hmm. the house that he died in, all those things. And there's no one that understands it but us. No one. You know, people have been through loss and that kind of thing. But when you're in it and you're living in it, and you've got kids that look like him and, you know, do things like him, and we've got these memories of him, certain, you know, times of the year that hit us, you know, this is what we did at this time of the year. For example, Super Bowl is going to come, you know, this weekend, and we just had friends here last year at this time, and we sat and had chili, and that was the best he was. And after they left, that's when everything got bad. So this is kind of like a little bit of a milestone for us, knowing that uh-huh. this was the best, and then it just got worse from there.
With the girls, when I was talking with them, grief is a lot like waves sometimes. Some of yes. the waves we see coming far out in the distance, and we can kind of expect like Christmas or holidays or dad's birthdays or their birthdays, things that are milestones that they know that they would really want him to be close. Then there are other waves that sometimes can come on and take us by surprise. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how to be prepared for those waves and what those coping tools would look like.
You had mentioned finding out what their hobbies are now after he's passed. They've grown so much with their hobbies. And mm-hmm. I think you said it perfectly when, you know, when Allie took on crocheting and rainbow loom and different projects, where she just sits there and her mind just goes away. Her mind just goes into a different place when she's crocheting or she's doing an art project. And Abby you know, she loves virtual stuff. She loves the Roblox and computer games and FaceTiming with her friends since she doesn't get to see them in person. And that just takes them away from the pain. I think the biggest thing that I've learned is hold on to those people that actually do make that effort, or call, you know, if you're sitting around waiting for a phone call because you're hurting, you need to call them. They don't know what you need. Nobody knows what to say. Nobody knows the right things to do. Sometimes you just need to tell them that they just need to listen and you need to cry to them. Because the worst thing I think I feel most guilty about is always crying to my kids, because that's all I've got. You know, I have the phone, but I don't have anyone physically here to grab onto and hug. So hold on to those people that actually check in. They may not have all the right things to say, but they generally want to be there for you. And there are some people out there that just don't know how to handle it. And I've figured that out. You know, they are great friends. I know that they'll be there for me, and I know that they'll do anything I ask. But the follow-up, you want that follow-up. You want them, when they say they want to help or they want to be there for you, you need that follow-up. You need to know that that's really true.
It's a weird year alone for everybody, but then to try to navigate loss and being an essential worker and being now displaced from your family that lives so far away and kind of off on this island, which is you and your girls. There have been a lot of back and forth of virtual school and having to quarantine and just all these ancillary losses. I know that one of your kiddos having to quarantine at Christmas meant that family that was going to come for the first kind of real holiday without Tom, they had to cancel their trip and they weren't able to come. Navigating all that extra kind of compacted loss, how do you feel like you were able to do that with the kids?
I got to say, it's their strength that got me through it. You know, anytime I break down, I feel like someone is there to pick me up. And I hate that it's my kids, but that's all we've got at this point. You know, I can pick up the phone and call my sisters. I can call my family back at home, whatever. But I mean, they're physically here and they see how hard it is and how painful it is. And they're living it too. So I feel like the only way I got through it is because of them. They were strong. They helped me be strong. And I knew that it just push on and get us through this no matter what. What I struggle with the most now is just making sure I'm the best parent I can be. I've learned how much he did on his end with work. He did a lot of the household duties that maybe most husbands didn't do. So I had to, you know, pick all that up. But there's got to be some balance between, you know, and I'm still figuring that out, to be myself again. And, you know, people like to say, well, you'll find somebody else or you'll move on. And those are the things that you just don't want to hear. Not one bit. Not do I ever think about in one moment, yes, I'm lonely. It would be so nice to have somebody here. But, you know, he was my best friend, my soulmate. And I can honestly say that because we waited a long time. I waited a long time to get married to him. We waited a long time to have kids, 6 years of infertility. We went through a lot together, a big move together. We've been through so much, and for his life to be cut so short, so fast, and it being such a shock, and so many people around him just love him dearly and all that kind of stuff. You'll hear a lot of words out there to move on, or, you know, there must have been a reason, you know, that God took him so soon. There's just some words that you wish people didn't say at that moment. I know they don't know what to say, but there's just some things that it's not going to make it better. A lot of times, I just need some people just to be on the phone ready when I need to call and scream. I could be out walking and I could be, you know, crying on the street and people are looking at me like I'm goofy. I would love to wear a shirt that says, you know, if I'm crying, it's because my husband just died, you know, my best friend. And I just, you know, the loneliness that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. It's something that nobody understands unless you go through it. You just don't. And everyone says it takes some time, and it does. And I can tell you that the pain, the shortness of breath, the chest pain, all that stuff that I the sleepless nights, the not eating or not eating the right things, not feeling good, all that stuff was at the very beginning. And I thought that would never go away. The not wanting to be in this life and hating that I would think that when I have two little ones, all that stuff just, it messes with your mind. And you just need to get it out and talk to somebody that understands.
Do you feel like connecting with a therapist has been something that you would have been open to right away? Or do you feel like it's something that you had to get to a certain point to be ready for it?
I had to be ready for it because I didn't think that I needed that. I've always kind of struggled with some anxiety issues, you know, and just never felt like I, you know, measured up sometimes. But just talking it out and talking to other people or even being in a support group, talking to others that have been through the same situation. I've actually been on a Facebook page with widows and, you know, they'll just put on there exactly what my feelings are and what I've thought about in the past or, you know, thoughts that have come across. And I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not crazy. This is normal. I am normal how I'm feeling, you know, because we don't like the way we feel after our loved one passes. We don't like the thoughts that come through our mind. We don't like the person that we are sometimes, but then we're proud of ourselves. I get really proud of myself when I change a light bulb for myself or I put the Christmas lights up and I did all the Christmas decorations. You know, there are certain things that you have these little celebrations too, that you did it.
So nice if somebody could just script, say this to somebody when their spouse dies.
Yes. And there's a lot of good podcasts out there that I found. And, you know, just listening to that, it, you know, some people's situation are so much worse than mine, but we're living in it and mm-hmm. my kids are living in it and I feel bad for them daily. And I just want people to love on them and as much as I do as well too, because I feel like they need that support too. I think just having, I guess, you know, support from other people, you know, and talking to somebody if you're just not sure you're navigating, because you're going to be really hard on yourself around the whole time. You're having to take on all the responsibilities of two parents. And during a pandemic, it's 10 times harder to do that, navigating the right decision to keep them home or put them in person to school, decisions to have one car versus two cars. You know, are you able to afford the house? And then just are trying to plan fun things for the family and trying to create new traditions, new fun things for us to do to keep us going. I think that's been my biggest struggle, is just having fun. Being present is, I'm realizing, is the most important part at this point. They need me more now than ever. And they're always making sure that I'm going to be home and, you know, and I'm going to bed at a decent hour. They're taking care of me a lot, but it's mostly just being present for them and being around more as a parent as much as I can. I have to learn how to do things for myself again and to be that single parent. And that's not something that I ever thought I would be doing. You can survive without him. It's just hard and it's not fun. You know, it's not the same. Life is not the same.
Thank you so much for tuning into our podcast today. Please continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For any recommendations or topics you would like to see covered, please feel free to send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.